Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the October DEEB meeting. My name is Ryan Wilson. I'm with Wilson Architects, and I am the current president of DEEB. So let's get started. Let's go ahead.
Seth Halling with AKS Engineering.
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Mike Odrin, McKay Sposito.
Eric Alimo, SJ Engineering.
Amy Housley, Jordan Ramos, in person.
Brent Davis, Clark County Community Development.
Victoria Abram for the Clark County Building Safety.
Brian Mullen, Harmony Towers.
Byron Waltersdorf with Civil Northwest Engineering.
Maya Bunn, Lesnar. Clark County Community Development.
Dan Community Clark Development.
Naomi Patibanlock, Development Engineering.
Diana Nutt, Development Engineering.
Ian Harkins, BIA.
Justin Wood, Clark County Association of Realtors.
And those online.
Houston Aho, Aho Construction.
Terry Wallman, Wallman Associates, DEEB member.
Les McDonald, Clark Regional Wastewater District.
Brian Mullen, Harmony Towers.
Lance Paulson, Gain Group.
Hi, I'm Chad Dragon, Finance Manager in Community Development.
Is there anybody else online that we didn't get?
Houston and Travis and
well, there might. I think our volume was low at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
So we might have missed a couple, okay. But
so it's Shannon's fault.
Yeah, Travis Johnson, PLS. I'm online, just listening in.
Yep, that's
Glenn Young, County Council, just listening in. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just as a reminder, this DEEB meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted on DEEB's website. Has anyone had a chance to review the minutes from our September meeting?
Mr. Chair, I have, word for word. I have no corrections to make and move for approval or adoption or whatever it is.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. Move on. Let's review upcoming events. Victoria.
It is a busy October, so we have two council meetings. One will be on October 14th for the moratorium mobile home manufactured home parks, some code updates for the Community Action Advisory Board, code updates for land use review, wetland habitat review fee updates, and then a regional park fee increase. On October 21st, there will be a council meeting for the code updates 2.95 risk management, and then also code updates for Title 14 and 15. For work sessions in October on the 1st, there will be a work session for fireworks, DNR presentation, and clean water fee reduction for schools. On the 15th, it will be the 2026 to 2031 stormwater capital plan, the 2026 annual construction program and transportation improvement program, and then also the draft 2026 to 2031 capital plan for the parks and nature and lands management. On the 22nd, there will be a work session for discussion with FBI regarding Camp Bonneville, the emergency medical services ordinance update, and the 2025 fall budget supplemental. And the last one on the 29th, there will be a work session for the 2006 annual budget and rural events centers. And then there's one planning commission work session on October 2nd, which is this evening at 5:30 for housing options study and action plan implementation for multifamily code updates. And as of September 30th, there were no planning commission public hearings. That's all we have.
Were the park impact fees, was that presented to DEEB?
I think that's the user fee for park entry.
Oh, okay. Sorry. That's not the PIF. Okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
Two things, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
There is the work session that Planning Commission is having on the housing option study. We should probably add that to our agenda as well. A few of us were on that committee.
Yeah.
And we did pass some stuff around, some comments. I know Dan had some. You had some, I believe, too. So maybe that, I don't know when we can get to that on our agenda. And then we also talked about the road mod, trying to get that on there. I think we wanted to have a brief discussion about that now, but then maybe have another meeting on that later. So I don't know if we add that to our agenda as number 6. Or do you want to do it earlier?
I was almost going to suggest making the Planning Commission regarding the housing options just part of the member announcements. So we could do that now.
Okay. yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we're at, I guess. But
yeah. So yeah, let's do that.
All right. So I did a bunch of work and did some review of the Commerce, the Washington State Department of Commerce, and what they considered affordable housing. And I believe that it's quite clear that affordable housing would include townhouses. Not only that, but if the code change that's proposed that would not allow for us to do platted lots in the medium density and high density, what that would force us as a county is that would mean a minimum lot size for townhouses going forward would be 2,000 square feet. And it would not allow us to do any smaller townhouse lots, which then gets, you know, it makes it smaller townhouses. And right now, I know that Ginn's got a 15-foot product that they're working on. Jeff Cragen has done 18-foot wide stuff. I have plans for 15, 16, and 18-foot wide plans in the city of Vancouver. I know Cragen said that if he was to develop his plans again and sell them in the market right now, he'd be at 369. So that's, I mean, that's almost, if you consider that the way the interest rates have fallen, that's almost meeting the home ownership requirement for the 60% AMI band. So by us not allowing us to do any kind of platting in this medium and high density stuff, we are greatly going to limit the ability to create affordable home ownership, which is required in House Bill 1120. So and I think we should ask the Planning Commission to basically push that back.
Right. And beyond that, my understanding was you were saying we could meet the density requirements of the zone, right? It's just the platting issue that.
Correct. I mean, they have greatly increased the minimum density up to 18 units, but I've done plats before at that kind of density. And so it's not difficult if you're going to have a smaller townhouse project or product that you can meet that kind of density. So we can still meet the density. It's just not allowing platting would eliminate townhouses. Now, the other thing is that we could build condominiums and make them an individual ownership, but the liability rules in the state of Washington greatly limit anybody's willingness to do condos. I have done condos in the past. I will not do condos with the way that the legislation, you know, the laws are passed. No.
And I believe there was a suggestion that maybe Deeb's position, rather than getting into so much in the weeds on townhouses and whatnot, just be that we don't remove uses. We just, you know, it's okay. It's great that the housing options plan is coming up with these new definitions and expanding our ability to develop, but they shouldn't be taking anything off the table. And it may be just as simple as that. That's our statement. So I guess part of not to push this forward, but I mean, one of the reasons I wanted it part is this with the talking, because that's tonight. So one of the questions is, how does Deeb want to proceed with this?
It's just it's a work session for them, so there's no public input, but I don't know where Deeb sits on the...
Are we allowed to have a statement or...
Well, we used to. Historically, we did. We submitted a memo to Planning Commission, or staff delivered the presentation, or someone from D would go to the Planning Commission meeting. I don't know if anyone's planning on going. Are you going to the meeting? Okay. Well, maybe you could deliver our position at the meeting.
Well,
if we took one.
I guess what I was hearing is that there's no public comment period in it. So I guess I'm wondering, what can we make...
Well,
deliver a position if there's not a public comment period?
Typically we would. Planning Commission used to, because we're not necessarily public. We're another advisory board on development and engineering. We're a direct advisor to council and indirect to Planning Commission. So we're kind of at equal place with Planning Commission that way. So it would be a peer comment, not really a public comment. So we used to do it historically. So one thing... Also, yeah, we could, as long as the board makes a motion and we're delivering it based on Deeb's position, I don't see why we couldn't. Staff used to present it, and we could put it in a memo. It's probably be difficult to do by 6 o'clock or whenever that work session is. That'd be a little challenging to get something put together. But I did type something up, I think, on the comments, and I circulated it. And I think that I tried to put what I thought a motion would be. And, you know, you summarized it well, but I think, you know, we're not going to increase flexibility by removing options. So there were two basic takeaways, I think, from the group that we commented on. One was, let's leave all the allowable uses. And then the other one was, do not change the minimum density. So don't raise those up, because there's situations that we don't even know about. The unintended consequences, you might have an oak tree or something that's not like excluded. You might have sloped property. You might have things where it just doesn't necessarily work, where we have to put the road network, may be really challenging. The market really takes care of the minimum density. Most of the time in multifamily products, you're trying to get the maximum density you can, the highest yield, to try to make the project work. So market really controls that. Good things that came out of the group was increasing that maximum density, so we can do higher density when it fits the site, when it's compatible with the neighborhood. So those were basically the two comments. And I put that in that email that I circulated to you guys, tried to summarize what it was. So we could cut and paste from that and put it in a memo. And those are basically the two things. I think that those were the two items that we talked about. So.
But does anyone from staff think that or have a way that can get delivered to the work session tonight?
And try my best to find out some information. Brent, do you have any?
Well, that's community planning's work. So it doesn't appear we have anybody from community planning here today. So, I think, you know, we can certainly let them know.
All right. Well, it sounds like you were planning to attend anyway. So maybe we'll just try all of our bases, and let's go ahead and make a formal motion, and then we can send it to Victoria. She can try to get it to somebody in planning staff, and then we'll make an attempt for Dan, and maybe I'll try to run out there, come back as well.
We do have some time, too, because there's still one more hearing. So this is the work session. What I anticipate is going to happen here is they're going to get it presented to them, and they're going to have a lot of information that they're absorbing because they weren't part of the group. So we could, you know, mention something now, but we could have a formal letter prior to their hearing. And that would probably be just as effective once they have a chance to process it.
Okay.
So I'll make the motion. I have the memo that I circulated to you. I can forward it to Victoria, and we can cut and paste from that. But basically, the two points are no allowable uses should be removed from the code, and these provide opportunities for home ownership and more flexibility. Also, the minimum densities should remain the same and not raised. Raising them has unintended consequences and may make constrained properties infeasible. The minimum density is really market driven and doesn't need to be raised. It may force development that is incompatible with the surrounding area and reduces flexibility. So that's what's in that email, and I'll send that, but I'll make a motion to take a position on those comments as written in the email.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. And it's okay, Victoria. You don't have to type it all right. We'll get it to you. Are there any other member announcements?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I've got two other matters. One, I did attend the council work session yesterday with the DNR representative talking about the aggregate issue in Clark County. I think it would be incumbent upon this body to get engaged with that based upon some of the information that the representative from DNR had mentioned and the shortage essentially that is going on there and the potential for the long term. What does the aggregate supply look like in the county? As these, a lot of these sites are moving offline and we have not permitted a new mine since I think the early 2000s up in Yakult. So that's item number one. And then item number two is yesterday the county released the draft environmental impact statement for the comprehensive plan. I think that you do have a comment period open until November 30th to do that. So I would encourage members of DEEB here to familiarize yourself with that, and maybe it could become a discussion point next month. Thank you.
Yes, I downloaded it and saw it was 286 pages and put it on my to-do list. The DNR one, my recollection of that was that council was had authorized a study to be like a natural resources study or land study. How is that? Where does that?
So the county council, as part of the GMA update, authorized a resource study, but it was only regards to the agricultural land. They did not touch forest nor the mineral resource land. And I think, you know, a couple of council members had asked that DNR come down and explain to them the process as it relates to the mineral lands. And I think what came out of that, listening to their presentation, was Clark County has not done enough to proactively designate those resources and protect them, and more sites are moving into the reclamation phase, and we haven't necessarily backfilled them with new mines coming on site. And so we have to have strategies around that going in the future, especially with the long permit time it takes to get these new mines online. So hopefully, I know one counselor is listening at least, that the council will look maybe to appointing a mineral lands task force to do this. And I think DEEB can have, you know, input, because it does relate directly to the work we do from, you know, a costing standpoint in terms of development projects.
Thank you. Are there any other? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I guess it's one of the items from the last meeting was about the public health and their development review letters. Some of them taking 3 months to get that and delaying our application of land uses applications. And just wanted to check whether there was any update. And Brent, for your benefit, we had talked about other jurisdictions in the county just require only proof of submittal and to be technically complete. And so it was, I believe the county used to follow something along that lines. And I don't know what it's been 8 years ago. Maybe they switched.
They would require the actual DR letter at the time of final engineering submittal is what they used to do. And then they started requiring it at the time of site plan review or subdivision preliminary submittal.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just yes, we're currently requiring it as a fully complete item, which I believe is part of the concern. I did review the code. It's only required as a fully complete item in our code for projects that are going to be using on-site septic or a well. My understanding is that the reason for the change for the rest of the applications was driven by input from public health, and primarily regarding concerns of ensuring that projects in the urban area that have to decommission an existing septic system or well are getting addressed. So I think legally we can shift the requirement to later in the process for developments that are not using septic or well. But I would like to coordinate with the health department in making that change and make sure that we're meeting their needs.
Thank you.
And I think we also had some discussion about having a representative from public health here next month.
Yeah, we're trying.
Okay. No.
Before we move on, we didn't get clarity. Are we going to talk about the road mod as item 6, or can we jump into that?
Sure. Well, yeah.
I suggest moving through our agenda as currently written, and if we have time.
Okay, can we move through the agenda swiftly? Because I do want to time for it. It's important.
I have one member announcement. Maya Bunch, Community Development. I just wanted to welcome Dan Kaler, our new Engineering Division Manager in Development Engineering.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good to meet you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
And also, I know we have road mod slated for our November DEEB meeting as well. So at that meeting, we're going to include some other stakeholders from the county to participate in discussion. Just for FYI.
Did you want to introduce yourself, Dan? Or
Yeah. So Dan Kaler. Previously, I worked with Clark County. I was here from 98 to 15 in with the GIS division. I was coordinator at that point, but started out as a civil engineer, worked in the Midwest for several years, and pursued some additional master's study in GIS. And that's really focused my interest in combining civil with GIS. But nonetheless, this last 10 years, I was with the city of Eugene, working with their permanent information center, dealing with mainly their floodplain certification and impact fees, and then also managing your GIS programs. But so it's good to be back home. I live in Clark County. Certainly want to serve the community where I live. Yeah.
Yep. Welcome. All right. Item 2, proposed WAC changes and the shoreline impacts. Brent.
All right. So earlier in the summer, Ecology released a public draft of rulemaking for changes to the WACs relating to shoreline. Staff did review those and provide comment to Ecology. I'm just going to go over some of the major changes that I saw, which were primarily in 173, 26, and 27. They are also making changes to 18 and 20 and 22, but those are really not substantive in terms of their impact on Clark County. Some of these do not affect the county, but still might be good for you to be aware of. Also, just be aware that the way it's currently proposed, we would not have to adopt these changes until we do our next periodic update, which is scheduled for 2030 under these rules. So it may be a while before you actually see any of these changes on the ground. And I'm not sure what the schedule is for completion of the rulemaking at this point.
At state level.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. So the first one is related to channel migration zones. There's currently language in the shoreline rules regarding designation of channel migration zones, but there's really no criteria for how to do it. In the proposed rules, they're providing some criteria for how to designate those, but it's still intended to be optional. We currently rely on FEMA mapping, and we don't go beyond the flood hazard areas to try and bring additional areas into shoreline jurisdiction because of potential channel migration. Not sure how much of a risk that might ultimately be for us in the future. Most of our shoreline streams don't have a lot of channel migration risk, other than perhaps the East Fork or the Lewis, the lower reaches. But if we are pushed that direction in our update, there are now criteria for how we do it. Or that's what's proposed, at least. Next item, in terms of addressing climate change, they're adding a sea level rise hazard area to the shoreline code. The good news is they're specifying which jurisdictions need to address it, and we are not on the list. But you may see that in other jurisdictions you work in. They're adding a definition for critical freshwater habitat. The current draft just noted that the language would be provided later in the process. But I did a search of the drafts and could not find where it was actually used in any of the rules. So I'm not really sure what its purpose is at this point. The next item is really more of something that will affect the county when we do our procedurally, when we do our updates. It's adding some environmental justice considerations, and it's primarily, I'll mention it a little later, but it adds some additional outreach requirements to try and capture input from communities that might be vulnerable or overburdened. So they're also adding a definition of floodway, and it's primarily intended for jurisdictions who aren't actually using FEMA mapping. So we use the FEMA mapping, so we shouldn't be affected by that. They're adding some provisions to address hazard trees. The current rules do not have any consideration for hazard trees, and it's something that we actually struggle with. And so they're proposing to define a hazard tree, put in some requirements for arborist assessment to determine the extent and risk, and then providing some guidelines for mitigation if trees are removed. It's not clear at this point whether that could be reviewed at some threshold under a shoreline exemption or if it would require a substantial development permit. So a couple things that affect the shoreline amendment process. They're changing the periodic review cycle from 8 years to 10 years. They're considering requiring when we do discretionary amendments between our periodic update period that we would have to be required to adopt any changes that ecology has made since our previous amendments. And then, as I mentioned before, there are going to be new requirements for outreach to vulnerable populations and overburdened communities. So there's several proposed standards for protection of shoreline ecological functions that are new. One is they're bringing in the mitigation sequence, which is already codified in SEPA. It's codified in critical areas ordinances. They're formally bringing it into the shoreline rules. It's already incorporated into our master program through our critical areas ordinance, so it won't really be anything new for us. They're proposing some specific riparian area standards, and it's not clear to me at this point if that language and those rules are going to be consistent with priority habitat recommendations. I certainly commented to the effect that they should be consistent so that we're not having to apply different standards in shoreline versus outside. They're doing some, I guess, language changing, and some of the things that are currently called setbacks, if their basis is related to ecological functions, they're looking at changing them to shoreline buffers. I'm not really changing the standards, just how they're referred to. And then there's some language regarding the potential for requirements to enhance or extend degraded buffers. And this is similar to language that's in their wetland guidance. The idea being that even if you're not impacting those buffers, if they're in a degraded state, that you would still have to do some sort of enhancement or make the buffer bigger. That's something that I've consistently been opposed to and commented consistently with ecology, that I feel is problematic from a regulatory perspective, both legally, and it's also difficult to implement because they don't, to date, haven't even provided any like objective standards on how you determine how much enhancement is appropriate or how much extension is appropriate. The next one, there may be some activities that they're proposing to be prohibited in the shoreline buffers that aren't necessarily prohibited in our CAOs. Couple of specific examples, retaining walls may be outright prohibited in those buffers. Again, these are the setbacks, so you know developments generally require variance in those areas anyway. And then it appears there may be some additional restrictions in those buffers on vegetation removal that go beyond what we currently have in our CAO. And again, the gist of my comments were that I would like to see consistent standards inside and outside a shoreline for the same ecological functions that we're trying to protect. There was another provision that appears to suggest that we may have to require some kind of shoreline authorization for management of invasive vegetation. And then they're adding additional standards for shoreline stabilization, primarily requiring an alternatives analysis to show that the stabilization is necessary or the stabilization techniques proposed are the best option, as well as an ecological impact analysis, which I presume could potentially drive decisions regarding mitigation. They're changing the definition of normal residential appurtenance, which plays into the shoreline exemption for new home construction. Currently, a shop up to 1,000 square feet is considered normal, and a total of up to 3 garage bays, whether it's detached or attached, is considered normal. They're removing shops. They're removing the number of garage bays, and it just says a garage is a normal appurtenance. It doesn't say whether it has to be attached or detached. So I've commented that we need clarity on that. There's currently an exemption for restoration projects that are approved by WDFW as ecological restoration. This is exemption is distinct from the preemption through the streamlined JARPA process, which is a formal permit process for restoration projects that Fish and Wildlife approves, and then you're exempt from county permitting. So this is sort of a second catch-all for those things that they don't necessarily qualify for that streamlined process. They're essentially proposing to remove that exemption. And they're proposing to require that we send all of our statements of exemption to ecology. Currently, we only have to send our substantial development permits. And of course, they get the variances and the conditional use permits because they're the decision maker on those. So moving forward, when this goes into effect, we would have to send all of our shoreline exemptions to them as well.
Yeah, and I've heard that was going to happen. Do they then need to approve those, or is that just a matter of letting them know?
It's a matter of letting them know. They're supposedly going to provide us with a form that we have to use, which may have some additional administrative overhead for us. My presumption is if they don't like the exemptions you're giving, that they're going to, or if they don't like the exemptions that we're granting, they're going to reach out to us and suggest that we change the way we're doing things. So I think it's just more oversight, general oversight. They're also proposing to change the criteria for the shoreline variance to essentially align with how they're interpreting some of the current language to explicitly state that you still have to meet no net loss of ecological function regardless of your variance. Again, I find this problematic because, you know, there's potential where the mitigation or the avoidance becomes a constitutional takings concern, and this prevents us from granting a variance for that and would force you as the applicant to go through the denial process with the ecology, appealed to the Shoreline Hearings Board, who may not be qualified to adjudicate a constitutional takings before you can get it into a courtroom. So those are the things I flagged when I did my review of those proposed changes. Any other questions about those?
Will you, once there's a little more certainty on some of these, will you come back and update us as far as what that end result is? Because some of these they're considering they're this, they're that. Once it's kind of locked in. Oh, that's right. You mentioned that Clark County wouldn't have to adopt these until you did the until 2030. But is this what will be going in, or is there still some question surrounding this? Because you've already commented.
They released a draft for public comment. I'm not familiar off the top of my head with the rulemaking process, whether there'll be a final draft released before it's formally adopted. But if that's the case, I'd be happy to keep track of that and come back and let you know if there's been any significant changes.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, I was looking at the process while Brent was talking. It looks like there's some virtual open houses still available later this month, October 21st, November 18th, and December 16th. So if you have comment to that, I would suggest looking there, providing that. And then they would have to adopt the rule formally, and that could get appealed.
I'll let our environmental group know, and hopefully they can provide comments as well.
All right, thank you. And we'll stay with Brent for Senate Bill 5184. We talked about this before. I think mainly our interest is just in the timing of that process and how it's going to get implemented, and when can we expect to see that from a planning perspective?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I can't answer that question. I don't believe this is going to be a community development effort. And what I provided pretty much explains why. The scope of the code changes that we have to look at is substantial and rises far beyond the biannual code amendment process, in my opinion. But if you are interested, I can go over this if it does interest you to hear, you know, what parts of our code will or may need to be changed.
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, the first thing I noted is that the bill is an amendment to RCW 3601 and not 3670A. So it's not a growth management. It's not part of the Growth Management Act. So that raises a question in my mind about whether or not, or what the Planning Commission's involvement is going to need to be in terms of doing these updates. Generally, we take everything Title 40 to Planning Commission, but that's primarily because Title 40 was intended to implement GMA. So I think that's a question that we're going to have to answer. So the first, I think most obvious change is it's going to be a substantial rewrite to our parking and loading standards in the table of what's required. It's probably going to simplify that section of code quite a bit. But there's also a lot of other places in code where we have specific parking standards that we're going to have to either revise or at least review for consistency. Some big ones are narrow lots, cottage housing, and the manufactured home park special use standards. We also have to look at Highway 99 and mixed use. Not so much related to the standards themselves, but we have triggers in site plan review for type 2 site plan, type 1 site plan that are based on the number of parking spaces or the change in the number of parking spaces that are required. So we just need to review that and see if those thresholds need to be revised or even make sense to be based on parking with the new standards. And we may need some alternate thresholds, or I can't really predict what that might ultimately look like. I also see the potential that at least at some point it could impact the exemption, categorical exemption thresholds in SEPA that are based on parking. And you know, maybe ecology might put forward an amendment to those flexible threshold standards. They may not. I don't know at this point. And then there's a list of special use standards that we definitely need to review. The agricultural stands and markets, coffee and food stands, home businesses, rural ADUs, because there's specific parking standards in there, retirement housing, staffed residential homes, bed and breakfast, parks, RV parks. And then outside of Title 40, there are parking standards in I've just referred to it as a one-time events, which are, you know, assemblies, concert, you know, there's a permitting process for those one-off, like large gathering type events. And there are specific parking standards in there. One other thing to make sure to point out is that this bill does not impact ADA parking requirements, and it does not impact EV charging requirements, or at least not specifically. To the extent that the number of spaces may change, that may affect how much you have to do.
Yeah.
And then the last point here is just some questions that I have about what some things in the bill actually mean that we're going to have to figure out as these updates move forward. First one is, in the context of that bill, are duplexes, triplexes, and quadplexes single family or multifamily? You know, are lodging establishments in residential districts residential or commercial in terms of parking requirements? The bill refers to commercial space and not commercial uses. So is outdoor seating for restaurant establishments, does that need to be considered in terms of the area that we're looking at? The exemption for commercial space is an interesting one. The bill exempts commercial structures 3,000 square feet or less from any parking requirements. So does that apply to individual buildings on a site with multiple buildings? Does each building less than that threshold exempt, or is it based on the total square footage for the site? And then do the standards apply to parks, whether they're public or private, as well as schools? I don't think that's clear. And then lastly, there's an exemption in the statute for jurisdictions. So basically, I guess you'd call it a reverse exemption. It's basically exempts us from having to apply those limitations to religious organizations. And I have a concern that might actually conflict with federal law, because generally we're not allowed to apply development standards to religious organizations, or certain aspects of religious organizations that are different from similar or other uses in the zoning district. So I don't see how we can say, well, churches have, you know, are subject to our current parking standards, but you know, these other uses are not. So we'll need to resolve that as well.
So it should be clarified that even though this Senate bill is essentially saying to the jurisdictions, you no longer have the ability to apply minimum parking requirements, right?
Well, there are limits to how many spaces we can require for certain uses.
Okay. But that doesn't mean that we can't have more if we want them, right?
Correct.
Okay. Just want to make that clear, that
you know, we're not limited by the number of parking stalls, that we could have more than what you are ultimately going to be.
It limits what we can require.
Okay.
I would also, just for scheduling purposes, the bill does say that we have 18 months from the date it became effective, which is, I believe, July 27th. Of 20, that would be
26.
Yes. So that's when we're legally obligated to be in compliance with the statute.
So kind of add on what Mike said, one thing that I've seen happen is kind of creep, where we don't want to penalize parking. So things that happen, things that could happen, is the densities could be changed, with the minimum density going so far where you actually can't put enough parking in to serve the multifamily, because, you know, the code only requires so much. So the density goes up so high where you have an apartment building with no parking. And then, you know, this is good intentioned, but there's going to be some impacts on existing neighbors and neighborhoods. If you don't provide the parking, it spills out into their neighborhoods. I know from working with multifamily builders, they require a certain number of parking stalls to fund it. So if you start limiting things where you change the densities, you end up not being able to get funding, et cetera. You know, limiting garage widths or driveway widths is another way that, you know, those get limited, and then it spills out into the neighborhoods.
I think the point is that I agree. I mean, the market is going to drive parking standards, but I think that's the motivation, is that it's not the jurisdiction that's driving parking standards, it's the market. The question is, are there going to be bad actor developers out there that put in minimum parking and then have a development that they can't fill?
I will say yes.
Well, to Eric's point, I can foresee a scenario where, because of site constraints, you're having a hard time meeting minimum density and providing the parking that is good design. And if we can only require so much parking, we may have to push you to meet that density, because you can still provide the minimum parking.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. And looking at the multifamily code, and we commented on this earlier, they're raising the minimum density so high, it's actually pretty difficult to put a building on that's economically feasible that has parking on site. You almost, some of these densities in some of these zones, you have to put in parking garages, and then it's not cost effective to build. So that's the problem with the minimum density increasing it so high. Allowing it is great, but taking those minimum densities and raising them like they're proposing in the multifamily code, that's going to have that unintended consequence of basically discouraging parking and pushing people out into the neighborhoods. So that's how these things happen. It's not intentional. It seems like a good idea, but unintended consequences.
And just, I guess what I didn't explain is, just in general, for single family, we're looking at one space per unit. For multifamily, one half space per unit. And for commercial, one space per 1,000 square feet.
Currently, that's the parking ratio for warehousing, I believe.
Well, that's identical to downtown Vancouver, but yeah. So,
but that's downtown Vancouver. Yeah,
right. We're trying to incorporate a very urban
right
design over the entire county, which yep is, yeah. Yeah. There were a couple that related to multifamily tax exemption programs. I do know if the county's interested in following those.
I do not.
Okay. Were there other bills that you wanted to ask about, Jamie?
No, we can maybe bring those other bills back next month.
Okay. All right. Land use review, wetland and habitat right review fee updates. Yes. Chad.
Good afternoon, everybody. I don't appear often before these meetings, so I'll introduce myself again. I'm Chad Dragon, finance manager in the Department of Community Development. Can everybody see that screen okay?
Yes.
Okay.
So I will, I know there's probably some new faces here that weren't here last year. So I'll just present things pretty much as I did last year and just go from the very, you know, the background of our cost recovery, you know, on up to where we're looking at now currently for the proposed fee updates. So purpose here is just to receive your feedback on, and I have a bit of a typo there, but just proposed fee updates for these programs. We don't have any new fee updates or new fees rather that we're asking for this year. So I'll start a little bit with the background. Our current cost recovery framework at the state level in the RCW is it allows reasonable fees from an applicant to cover the costs of processing applications, inspecting and reviewing plans. At the Clark County code level, our application and service fee policy, we are to adopt application and service fees at a level necessary to recover the costs of conducting the reviews or providing the services. And then general fund support for key activities will be identified where necessary. Revenue sources. In our department, we're mostly funded by fees, and best practices in county code would dictate that the fees we charge should cover those costs of providing services. This includes not only salaries, benefits of staff, but providing the services, but also indirect costs like office rent, copier maintenance, department overhead that's allocated out to each program. Those costs, which cannot be tied to processing the applications or aren't subsidized by council in any way, must be covered by other funding sources. In the case of community development, we have a couple of small grants, but normally it's going to be general fund dollars. What are the main drivers of this general fund support in the past? In the past, we've had sporadic fee updates in these programs. And so, you know, with costs generally increasing every year, the fees just haven't been updated to keep pace with that. And so last year, we completed a major cost of service study and a major fee update for both of these programs. Intentional subsidization of program costs by previous councils. General fund support for fee work, which is also known as we call public share, that has happened in the past where previous councils have subsidized the fee work itself. There's also been allocation of general fund dollars for non-fee supported activities like customer service to applicants, which we don't charge a fee for, and also Clark Conservation District. One way to lessen our department's reliance on the general fund dollars is, of course, making sure that the fees we charge reflect the current costs of providing the service. And as I mentioned, last year, we completed a major fee update, which was the first in almost 15 years. The fee model used was reviewed and approved by the county finance team. And the result is that the fees in these programs, they now reflect what it costs currently to provide those services, not what it cost back in 2009 or 10. And we are projecting our general fund request for these programs this year to be about 27% less than last year. This slide here gives you just an idea of the kind of general fund support that the programs have received in the past. And as you can see, leading up to 2024, we got to the maximum, you know, at least, you know, from the previous 5 years or so, we reached more than we had previously asked for. But as you can see in 2025, we are projecting considerably lower requests for general fund dollars. And that is in large part due to the fee updates that we passed last year. If our 2026 fee proposals are adopted as proposed, we estimate that in land use, we'll just see about an average increase of about 2%, bringing in about $30,000. In wetland and habitat review, it'll be about 3%, bringing in $19,000 of additional revenue. The department held the work session with council on August 13th, 2025. And although the feedback was minimal from that work session, there was a question about why our increases appear to be lower than cost increases generally across the county. The reason for that is the methodology we use to calculate our overhead that we allocate in the department to the programs was changed based on guidance from the state auditors. And so that resulted in lower amounts of overhead being allocated to these programs, which offset some of the wage increases that we had from the Me Too grievance outcome, as well as the other related payroll costs that go with that. Next steps for us, we're here today presenting these fee proposals to you, and I have a couple of different slides I can show you after this with the actual fees. We will be returning to council for our public hearing on October 14th. It's a bit of a tight timeline here. And then after that, we will work as hard as we can to import those fees into the system, get them updated, and make sure everything's calculating correctly. So with that, I wonder if anybody has any questions. Or if you would like to just see a basic rundown of the fees.
Real quick, Chad. I remember years ago, there was a certain percentage of fees that was subsidized by the general fund. And I don't remember if it was at what percentage it was, 15% or something sticks in my head. Has the county completely done away with any subsidization of fees from the general fund, which leads to this 100% cost recovery?
Yes. Subsidization of the fees is with 100% cost recovery. That means that what it costs the county to provide the services is being recovered in the fee. Now, there are some things, as I mentioned, that still require general fund dollars that aren't covered by fees. We call them non-fee supported work. And those are things that those are the reasons why we still have an annual general fund request.
Okay, perfect. And the second part of my question is, when you're calculating the increase or in some cases decrease in the fees, are you basing that on the average amount of time that it takes to go through any one particular review, or are you basing it on the lowest common denominator?
We calculate our fees based on the average time it takes to complete each type of review or service that we offer. And those are our land use review manager, Brent, could speak more into more about the way that we calculated those, but that is essentially the equation. It's our fully burdened hourly rate times the amount of hours that we feel each service would take, and then that equals the fee.
Great, thank you.
How do you guys typically respond? Because I mean, the number of permits goes up and down every year, it seems like. So how are you?
So when we did the fee updates, the major fee update last year, we based our estimates of hours, average hours for each fee service based on 4.5 years of actual data. And so when I looked at those estimates, and reviewed those estimates as part of this update process, I essentially compared the data that was new since that analysis up to, I think at the time it was up to the end of June of this year, to see if there were any changes warranted. And this fee update doesn't reflect any changes to our model for the amount of time for each fee service.
Okay. Were there a couple other slides you were going to show, Chad?
Yes. Okay. So here is the, and I'll blow this up a little bit. Here's the screen with the proposed land use review fees for next year, 2026. And they're just in order of code reference in Clark County Code Title VI. So as you can see, the first one here, appeals to a hearing examiner. The current fee is $2,024. We're going up about $40. So that's essentially what we're looking at here. We have a lot of, obviously a lot of fees in land use, wetland habitat. We can more easily fit on a screen or two, but the detail here is just the current fee, what we're proposing, and the change. And if you had any particular fees you wanted to look at, I could try to find those.
What is the 2.5% for the tech fee compass?
That is a fee that we have not charged in the past that is, it's common throughout the state with cities and counties, but it's essentially a bit of a surcharge to ensure that we have the funds necessary to keep our technology, like the permitting system and all of its support going and up to date and, you know, as well funded as possible. And then to also plan for future upgrades or maybe possibly a new system.
And that was already in the current fee, correct?
That's in the current fee as of last year's update. Previously, it was not. So we added it as of last year.
I mean, initial glance, they seem pretty reasonable and in line with what I'd expect, if not even a little, you know, they seem pretty modest and right. Reasonable.
One quick question. Are there any changes to the issuance fees?
No changes to issuance fees. That is something separate that I do have to look into, but yeah, unfortunately, no changes this year.
No, you don't. No.
All right. Any additional questions for Chad? Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chad.
You bet. Thank you.
Victoria, Title 14 and 15.
So this is going to council for the Title 14, 15 updates. They are very simple. A lot of them is just administrative changes. There's no new language technically being added that would change any building requirements for the IRC or the IBC. I just wanted to bring it to your attention, though, today before it goes to council on the 21st. So background and purpose, our Clark County Code Titles 14 and 15. Currently, they reference the 2015 International Code. Model codes, and we would like to adopt those codes by reference. So when the state adopts the new three-year code cycle as the international codes, the county would therefore just adopt those code by reference. This would include the revision of Title 14 to only include the sections that the county has adopted as more restrictive than the Washington State Building Codes. And then we're going to also update Titles 14 and 15 to align with the reference materials. So in the ordinance, I'm going to be able to get that out hopefully by the end of the week for review, just the draft ordinance. It's currently in a peer review right now. It's a very long ordinance, but a lot of the changes we're updating, like our titles, it references Title 106 in the IRC, which is fees. However, the IRC, or it's been changed, their fees is now Section 107. So we need to update our Clark County code to just match the reference materials. Next slide. This is just overview of Title 14. The main changes are to 1401 for the adoption of the building safety codes, and then 1405 for the international building code, and then 1406 for the residential code. The mechanical and plumbing code did have some of the chapter changes, but no text changes. Next slide, please. Title 15, there are no changes to any of the text. We would like to keep all the amendments as they currently are. The only updates are going to be updating the chapter titles and the names to the reference materials to the International Fire Code. Next slide. So we're just going to run through the main changes. Starting with Title 14, Building and Structures, where applicable, we're going to update numbers, amending, repealing or adding provisions of the international codes to align with our reference materials. We're going to strike the adopted code year, which is currently 2015, and get that updated to reference by, to adopt by reference. We are also going to add additional titles, the ASCE and then the ICC ANSI, which I believe is the ADA compliance. We're going to provide links to the Washington State Building Code Council and the I-codes, which is hopefully going to make it easier for our applicants to get a hold of the Washington State amended building codes. We will be hopefully removing a building exemption regarding the minor construction alteration projects that are less than $1,500, not including plumbing, mechanical, or trade permits. Those projects also can't change any exiting lighting. So it's been in the code. It was an optional adoption that cities and counties could adopt. The county did adopt it, but it is currently not in the IRC or the IBC. I believe it stemmed from the 1991 Uniform Building Code. So since it's not in the IRC or the IBC, we would like to remove that from our code. Next slide, please. For section 108, remove language regarding fees to the related to the automatic fire extinguishing systems. This duplicated language is located in our Title VI for our fees. We will be updating the basic wind speed requirements to 135 miles per hour, which is prescriptive, or will allow for engineered design. I think right now we are enforcing the 135 miles per hour. It's just that our code isn't up to date. This next one for the snow loads is actually a typo. The roof snow load will stay at 25 pounds. However, the ground snow load will be 30 pounds per square foot. We're going to add residential fences over not over 7 feet high, as that is recognized by the I codes as an exemption. And then that's also the remove that same building exemption, as it's just a duplicate since it's referencing a 1406 versus chapter 1405. We'll add some clarifying language for residential, for the International Residential Building Code. There's no changes to the text. It's just clarifying language that wasn't in our title, but is in the IRC. And then we'll also update the wind speed for the IRC as well for prescriptive or to allow for engineer design. Next slide. And then Title 15, very simple. We're going to update the numbers to align with the reference materials, and then we're going to strike the adopted code year and reference the current code as adopted by the state of Washington. And that is a quick rundown of Title 14 and 15 changes.
Everything look good, Ryan?
Well, Victoria sent this earlier, and I was very surprised to find out that I could have been submitting projects under the 2015 code for the past 10 years.
I'm glad this is happening.
I will say the reason Clark County uses the 135 as the prescriptive wind speed is because there are portions of Clark County that are at that along the gorge, but not all of Clark County. I mean, City of Vancouver only has 90 miles per hour, and 135 is a significant, that's a big wind load, and it makes a big difference on structural engineering. So that's one thing I would probably really encourage you guys to take another look at, even if it's a matter of, because there are the maps in the IBC, and I think a lot of it was just, it's really difficult when you look at those maps to figure out whether and where an actual address fits. But there are web pages that can do that nowadays. And so I almost feel like you could almost put it on the applicant to say, if you can show from, I don't remember the names of the web pages that do it, but there are web pages out there where you can see what the average wind speed is, and it's code based by address. So
I do believe, after speaking with Michelle Finley, we are, I can send you the language out of the ordinance. It does have some additional language in there about talking about the tables. And
yeah, if you can prove that it's,
then you can do this. So I can send you that language just so you can take it.
Okay. Yeah, that would make a big difference on a lot of projects.
Absolutely.
With the change to current adopted code, does that mean the county is adopting it as soon as the state code council adopts it, or because like the implementation of, the 2021 didn't occur until 2024 in the county. Is that the way it's going to be updated?
State enforces it to be for all counties and cities to adopt and enforce the code cycle. We would move forward on that date. So I think the 2021 code was sometime in July, but it was, I know they postponed it there for a minute.
Yeah. Well, and the state actually really,
I thought it was more,
they give a lot of deference to local jurisdictions. Clark County in the past has always had kind of a rolling clock, or not always, recently they have, and most other jurisdictions, which I really like. It's a great feature to be doing that, because it was so tough when you had July 1st, this is happening. Well, building departments were getting 100 building permit applications on June 30th because everybody was trying to beat the code change. But you have that rolling, it makes a big difference. Next year is another code change cycle, so we have to deal with it again soon.
Thank you. So I know we have an agenda item for our November meeting to talk about road mods, and that's become a very big issue as it's turning out to be kind of a big hurdle for a lot of development projects. Unfortunately, Jamie is not going to be able to be at the November meeting, so he has asked for a special allowance to make some on-the-record comments. So.
I'm going to be in glorious Hawaii, so.
There's a remote option.
There is a remote option. I may have to do it from a beach and a Mai Tai. Of course, it'll be earlier there, right? Where do I begin? We've been getting a lot of, obviously a lot of us at the table, we hear from a lot of different constituents over the times about things that DEEB should be addressing. I don't think I've ever seen my inbox and telephone for that matter be flooded as much ever on an issue as the road modifications. And it's really kind of coming to a head within the consultant community, not only from civil engineers, but land use planners, traffic consultants, clients, myself have experienced it. And it's clear to me that the process has fundamentally been broken. So I know that we are going to have a conversation about it next month, but I thought it was important to be aware that there's people online that are joining us because of the importance of this issue. I know Mr. Waltersdorf is here as well. And maybe he can at public comment time express his point of view on some recent issues that he's had there as well. But in sort of going back and looking at the history of the road modification process, there's been a lot of change in staff and a lot of change in the DEEB members. And so there's been a lot of loss in institutional memory. I went back, thanks to Eric, he helped me sort of resurrect some old emails from back in the 2009-10 timeframe when I was at a different law firm at the time. But during that time, the county, about 2010 through 12, they had instituted a process called retooling our code. And some of you may remember that just sort of tangentially. Some of you may have served on various subcommittees that were related to various aspects of that code section. And they did things in sort of batches as they were revising Title 40. But one of those specific items that came through the process was the road modification process, because at the time it wasn't necessarily working for staff nor the development community, the consumer. And with that, there was a subcommittee that was formed. I think it was initially Steve Schulte had formed it. I think Eric was one of the initial participants on that. I think Chris Bremer at Kittleson Engineering, Greg Jellison of HDJ, who I don't think he was on DEEB at the time, Rick Darland, Mike Bomar was with SWACA. I joined as a representative for DEEB. Sue Steppen was there. I think Ollie was there, Bill Wright, and maybe one or two other county staff. But the process had been totally redone, and the impetus behind that was to make it efficient, so we could get feedback immediately on road modification requests, because if some can be fatal to projects before you could even get out of the gate. So that was sort of item number one. But item number two was, it was really meant to have sort of a dialogue with staff to make sure that they're understanding that, road modifications, they have downstream sort of cascading implications for the rest of the project if they're not approved. And I think having a side conversation with Eric, I think it was last week, we had mentioned that when the consultants or applicants are bringing forward road modifications, they're not bringing for them out of the joy of going through road modifications. They're not at all. It's because you're having those serious code conflicts where they're trying to
design a site efficiently, but have, you know, other things that are setbacks or stormwater or this or that, that, you know, we're trying to serve all these different various code silos or code masters, as I say, and trying to balance that into a project that can be economically viable and meet what the target is. At this point, I think, again, just having heard it enough from the consulting community, calling my phone, writing emails, we're at a serious inflection point where something needs to be done. And I think it needs to get back to the basics, you know, stuff that we had what was meant to be the process. You know, we should really reflect on what the intent of that was in 2010 when it's designed, because it's slowly, I don't want to say bureaucratically, but it's led away from what the intent was. And so I'm going to pause there for a moment. I think Eric, since you were there, have maybe different memories, reflections, I'd like you to say your piece.
You know, I mean, that process was trying to simplify it, try to make it predictable, try to make it collaborative, constructive, and make sure that we got to a good point. And at that time, it was right during the recession, and there was a lot of collaboration between the development community and staff. Staff was getting laid off. They didn't have work. We realized how connected our industries actually are and how linked our livelihoods are. And there was a lot of motivation to make it easier to deliver housing, to get projects through the system. And what we're seeing, I'm not sure when it changed, but it seemed to change fairly like recently and drastically, where when we submit road mods, we don't submit road mods that we feel are unreasonable. Like they said, we're not doing it just because we want to do it. There's challenges to projects. There's balancing competing interests. There's cost. There's stormwater. There's middle housing. Our transportation code is really written more for greenfield development. Well, we're not adding anything to our urban growth boundary over the next 20 years. What we have left have a lot of challenges. It's in areas that are primarily developed. Looking at circulation standards in those situations really doesn't even make any sense. You're looking at constraints like critical areas, existing development. You know, the traditional block lengths don't even really matter. And even when they're met, like I just had an example, and I'm still kind of trying to figure this out. We meet east-west block length. We were told at the pre-app that we didn't need to submit a road mod for that. We submitted a road mod for north-south, and we got denied on east-west. I don't even know how that happens when it meets code. So going back through, like, I'm not sure what happened, but historically, I would say 90-95% of the road mods that were submitted were approved, and now it's probably 5% are approved, and that's usually after a lot of meetings back and forth, and I'm not sure what changed. Is it like attitude, culture? I'm not positive, and I'm trying to figure out how to get that back on track and how to have that good communication to make it collaborative, constructive, and most of the time accommodating. If there's a reason why something's denied, there should be a pretty good reason for it. And I'd like to hear from staff directly. I'd like to have that opportunity to explain it to them before kind of a line's drawn in the sand and they have to go back on it. Because I feel like there's a lot of resistance to changing your mind once it's made and once something's put on paper. So the way I understand it happening right now is that it's presented to the review engineer. The review engineer proposes it and summarizes it for the road mod committee. Well, that review engineer probably doesn't know everything that the applicant knows. They don't know why it was there, how many competing interests. They don't have the financials on the project. They don't know what the density is. There's a lot of things besides transportation that affects the road modifications. So what's being delivered to staff is not the whole picture. So you can say, oh, we reviewed what was in the what we were presented. Well, what's presented, it's kind of like the thing. If I tell Mike something and Mike tells Dan something and Dan tells Seth something, it's going to seem totally different. They don't have the whole story. Decisions are being made, very significant decisions, and it's not coming from the person who's actually submitting it. It's coming from a summarization of half the picture. So we have to find a way to make it better. This is preventing the type of density we need to meet our future goals. It conflicts directly with middle housing. It conflicts with our comp plan. It conflicts with stormwater requirements that have to reduce impervious surface. There's so many competing interests. We need to fix it. We need to – two things I think can help fix it. One, we need to have an accommodating and more collaborative road mod process. and better communication throughout the process. And then two, I think we need to look at our code again. I think we can eliminate almost at least half the road mods. I know I think staff may be getting annoyed by the workload they have because these projects that we're submitting are more challenging than they used to be. I don't think we have very few projects are submitted without a road modification because the code's so restrictive. So I think staff might be saying, can't they just design to the code? Why do we have to do all these road modifications? Well, let's look at the code then. Let's figure out how we can get rid of it and how we can make staff's job a little easier through code. And then the other piece too is communication can save a lot of time. I recently had some denied and talked to people, and then I was extremely shocked to get another denial after meeting with them, after explaining a few things, without a phone call or anything. I got it in the email. It's like, you know, if someone's going to say, we don't care about your project, we don't care if we're taking this development and it is no longer feasible, and it's a project that was barely feasible to begin with, a middle housing project that we're trying to incentivize, and the profit margin on it was maybe 100,000, and that's barely covering the risk, and now it's negative 800,000 because of this one road mod decision, that development's not going to happen. We're not going to meet our comprehensive goal plans. And if someone wants to do that, I'd like them to like explain it to me, look me in the eye, say why what the reason for the denial is this important to the general public. Because what I'm saying, there's very little benefit to the public. If anything, it's significantly impacting the neighbors and making their properties non-economically viable to develop as well. So we need to find a way to get to something more collaborative and fix the process. It's not just us. We have a dozen at least complaints on this issue right now that have come through Deeb. Significant. Almost every consultant that does these has had an issue. So it's not one person, it's not one consultant, it's not one project, it's across the board. So that's an indication that there's the problem is bigger than we think, and it's pretty significant. So.
Okay, and we are hoping to workshop this next month. So
I think with that, I think if we could get some guidance around what it is we as Deeb want out of that work session next week, that was really what I'm hoping to get, more clarity on the agenda. So they staff comes prepared, the Deeb members come prepared, and or if we want to allow other commenting affected public, consultants that are affected by this to speak their piece or provide us information. I think it's important to get that guidance also.
Victoria, what do we currently have on our agenda for next month? I don't want to pull up the email. Do you remember? Hang on.
Well, we were trying to get public health, but that should be quick.
Yeah.
I did put a placeholder for road mods.
Yeah.
100%. I just don't remember what the first.
Right. Hang on. Let me see.
I think those were the only two items that we really had. Was hoping to do workshopping 2026 in December.
Yes, and OTAC will be back on the December meeting to present some stormwater changes.
Oh, okay. Oh, OTAC. Yeah.
I have a bit of a concern about kind of opening up the floodgates to every consultant that wants to have a venue to voice their particular issue. I might suggest that we keep this at a higher level and work towards more what Eric has mentioned. Each project has its own specific challenges. That's understood. To go through each one of those individual specific challenges, I don't think is going to be beneficial.
It'd take forever.
Yes, it would. So really, I think that it would be good to have the support of the development community to listen, and that they can certainly provide, some written comments. We just don't have the time in an hour and a half to have everybody speak their piece. but that we keep it at a higher level and that we kind of try to do a reset like we did back in the late 2000s with retooling the code, which I remember, very distinctly. I was on the commercial code rewrite committee, and it was very collaborative at the time with staff. And I think that the first thing that we have to maybe focus on is, like Jamie said, the culture and how can we approve, starting with yes. It seems that there's been a shift to starting with no. How can we get this approved rather than what is it about it that will cause the denial? And that is actually a cultural shift in an organization, and it's not just specific to Clark County. It's across the board. It's with private organizations and other jurisdictions, and it's really what is it that we can do in order to support, because staff are partners in all of these projects that we do. They are an integral part of it. We want them to be a part of it. I would hope that staff wants to see these projects be successful, not only to meet certain GMA requirements, but also, you know, for the benefit of the community as a whole. So to your point, what are we looking to do? How much in involvement do we have with the public? You know, let's have a roundtable. Let's invite staff up here and start that conversation. And let's get through the first things in the agenda, first thing at our next meeting, and then let's just start that conversation. And it may not end that day. It might continue on. I would encourage council and county manager to listen in. Want this to be, as Eric has said, collaborative. And I'm taking a position here a little outside of that because I don't really deal with a whole lot of road modifications. I've seen the challenges with design and needing to address some of those. Yeah, I've been in projects that have had them approved and had them, you know, then and ones that I knew that weren't going to happen, so we've just withdrawn them, regardless of the evidence that we provided to the benefit of the project. But let's start that process that way. Good. Would you agree?
I'll say yes. And I want to note that we have the county manager and a counselor online who are listening in. I know it's a priority for them as well and for staff. And we thank you for your feedback, and we want it to be a collaborative effort. We really do. And I know we have a lot of staff members here, and we have some part of the process who are not in the room. So I would want to make sure all of our internal stakeholders are at the table to speak to and listen to feedback. So thank you for the opportunity to collaborate here. And I would concur also that it's not going to be one and done. I see this being a few steps. Let's take our time. Let's work through it. I think I'll stop there. If staff have any other comments, you're welcome to jump in. But thank you.
I'll just kind of finish with and just something to keep in mind and maybe noodle on for the next month. Most of the other jurisdictions that we work in, when we submit a road modification, there's one, maybe two people that make that decision. I don't know how many people are on the road mod committee, 4, 5, 6. What is unique or special about the Clark County jurisdiction that requires the input from so many when other jurisdictions have public works director or making the one decision, or the transportation engineer making the one decision on a road modification? I just want to kind of throw that out there because I don't know. I'm trying to get my arms around it. We submit a road mod to the city of Vancouver. There might be some discussion internally, but there's one person that is ultimately we hear back from that makes the decision.
We can certainly discuss that and with others here. And I just would also like to give our staff the opportunity to talk about the things they are doing and what we are working towards. So would appreciate that. Thank you.
It might be that a subcommittee might be necessary as well to work kind of directly. There's going to be a lot of work here, and it's probably not something we can do in an hour and a half in our meetings. So typically what we've done is we've kind of split out with the professionals. And I don't know if we can get a few people together, a few examples. I've been making a list of potential code changes that could eliminate a lot of road modifications. And I might try to put those on paper. Things like there's details out there where something's shown for reference and it's being taken as, you know, it is. And it, things like on a T hammerhead, sidewalk goes all the way around it. That's for a public road where sidewalks required. And when lots front it and the sidewalk's not even built until the lots are done, it can be changed really easily to say, this is the shape and sidewalks provided to provide pedestrian circulation. It's not needed all the way around where no one will take it. And there's not even lots over there. And it's meant for a public road. That's one.
This is a good discussion for next month.
Thank you.
It's 3:30. I don't want to start getting into design changes at this point. All right. That is the end of our agenda. So at this point, I will open it up for public comment. Are there any members of the public who would like to speak?
Yeah, I will. I mean, Jamie asked me to come and talk about the road mod process. In our case, I had a county engineer that worked on the frontage improvements back in the day, and they came to a negotiated settlement of keeping two driveways instead of three. Staff now says, well, because somebody came in for a site plan review for a one food cart, now that changes everything and everything's off the table and we're gonna make you close, dedicate, do a whole bunch of different things where maybe a tenant doesn't have the ability to do that. And now his project cannot go forward because it only is impacting three or six PM peak hour trips, which is nothing, which is no impact at all. So with that and staff coming back with no analysis of the contrary, but also saying, yeah, we agree with the road mod, we agree, but we're going to make this condition. It seems a little arbitrary without any discussion afterwards or during the process of the developing the condition. So we are currently appealing that decision for that taco cart or that food cart, and hopefully we can come to some type of agreement where, you know, the county designed it, they built this intersection, these improvements, they increased the safety because of these improvements, and there is no impact with this proposed development. So thank you.
I see we have one hand raised.
Okay.
Councillor Young.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to address you. I would just say, first of all, this is just one councillor out of five, so I'm obviously not speaking for the majority of the council, but I appreciate the discussion that took place on road mods. And I think the thing that I noticed of all the stuff that was mentioned is the fact that Clark County is changing. We're not expanding the urban growth boundary. And so we're starting to fill in the properties that have always previously just been passed over because they're more difficult to build. So what I would like the group to consider discussing specifically is, does our road code need to be changed generally? I mean, I think it's a better way to look at it to see if we can make the code fit the scenario that we currently have, rather than seeing what kind of a system we can build to keep doing essentially exceptions to the rule. So that would be what I'm really interested in hearing about is, does our road, the code that dictates how our roads are constructed, does it need to be changed, or do we need to add part of it that would reflect infill development versus greenfield development, things like that. But But I'll let you guys do your discussion. I appreciate all the work you guys do.
Any other public comment? Hearing none, we are adjourned.